Hi, this is Pirate Nick.
And this is Tiffany, the lass.
And we're here with Andrew Shapter, the director and co-writer of Before the Music Dies, and currently working on a documentary called The Greener Side. Hi, Andrew.
Hello.
So tell us where you are right now when we're conducting this interview with you on the phone on the road, right?
Right. I'm in Clarksdale, Mississippi. And if you're familiar with anything about Robert Johnson and the Crossroads or Homer's Odyssey or anything like that, that's where I am.
So before we get to Before the Music Dies, let's talk a little about the documentary you're working on right now, The Greener Side. What's this documentary about?
We're doing a documentary on the pursuit of happiness here in America. It just turns out that there are, the wealthiest countries in the world tend to rank a lot lower in terms of satisfaction, being content, and being happy than some of the poorest countries in the world. And there's some great studies in the UK that point to this. And so we're looking at that, and we're just trying to find some of the happiest people in this country and get some advice from them. And we're really kind of seeking out all those great things that are free in life and trying to exploit them. And it's a bit of a comedy, too.
Well, now, with such a large subject, how do you find people to interview? What are you doing? How are you seeking them out?
Well, yesterday is a good example where we just pulled over in a small town called Lake Providence, Mississippi, or Lake Providence, Arkansas, right on the Mississippi River. And I have my girlfriend and my daughter with me, and we don't seem like a Hollywood crew, or Michael Moore or Barat. We seem pretty harmless. And so we interacted with the town folk for a little while. My daughter played in the playground, and after a while I started asking questions, and I realized there was a church service in an hour away. So we wound up going into the church and filming the choir and talking to the people about joy and happiness. And I'm starting to believe that this whole thing rings true, that those people that are just content with what they have and they're not on this sort of crazy career path or they're not trying to seek out more money or wealth, they're just happy with the way their life is, seem to be far more fulfilled. And that was apparent yesterday with some of the people we talked to.
Is this documentary going to take you around the world?
Yes, indeed, it should. But it's a lot of it's going to be concentrated in Latin America and North America, being that Latin America is was the highest rank on this NEF study, New Economic Foundation study, the Happiness Index, and we have Panama, Nicaragua, Costa Rica ranking in the top 10, and so we're going to spend a lot of time down there too.
Great. And when do you think this it will be released?
This film will come out in March. 2008, all over the world, I hope, or at least it premieres March 2008 in North America.
Great, we can't wait.
If it's anything like Before the Music Dies, it's going to be fantastic.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Well, let's get to that. Before the Music Dies, if our listeners haven't seen this film, they definitely should. It's a fantastic look at the music industry and how it's changed and how it's coping with the new digital revolution that's taking place in the way people acquire their music. And one of the things that I thought of when I was watching the film was, you really, a big focus of the film, I thought, was on forgotten acts, forgotten bands, people that are not found by the music industry these days. And I was wondering what it was like for you to choose the people that you'd feature in the documentary, because you're really trying to show people watching the documentary, people that they should see that they haven't seen.
That's exactly it. I think a lot of the bands that we chose were bands that weren't like flavor of the month type bands. They weren't acts, or they were bands, and they were musicians and bands that built a following through the good old fashioned playing live, and that's really what attracted us to choosing those particular bands was they were building an audience one show at a time, and instead of signing with a label and then having them spend $500,000 on advertising and tying in product placement and looking for the skinny blonde of the month, so. For us, it was like, what are those bands? Like, for example, North Mississippi All-Stars from Coldwater, Mississippi. those guys have been playing for, you know, all of their lives. And so, you know, hearing from them was a treat. And then rediscovering people like Les Paul, Hubert Sumlin, and then, of course, Elvis Costello and Bonnie Raitt as well. These people are still out there playing live shows. Les Paul is in his 90s, and he's still playing at the Iridium nightclub in New York to this day.
I wanted to ask you, you exposed some secrets or music industry standards that most fans don't know about. And I wanted to ask you one thing about requesting songs on radio stations. We're fans of Ben Quayler's, and I was surprised to read on his webpage that his song Pinning on the Train Track was released for radio about 5 months after his album had been out. What does this mean? And because I'm always calling radio stations to request songs, and of course they're never played, but I wanted to get it from the expert.
Well, I can tell you this. When you consolidate, one thing that, you know, one of the biggest impacts that radio consolidation has, where all of these different radio stations were bought up by one company, is that you're taking the programming director, the person that decides what music gets played, and you're taking the DJ out of the equation. And what you're doing is you're putting together all of these, you know, all this music in front of a focus group and then choosing, you know, 30 songs for the month.
Mm-hmm.
And so regional musicians from your area or Austin or here in Mississippi won't get heard if that corporate headquarters in San Antonio, i.e. Clear Channel, don't approve it. And so if you're going to call a DJ, the DJ is going to fake his way through and say, okay, thanks, we'll work on that, goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
And talk to DJs all over the country that just said the same thing over and over again. Is that if we could, we would play it. But right now we're stuck to having to play this focus group music. And it was sad because it's the programming directors and the DJs that can make or break a music scene. And if a local band can't get played on their local rock radio station or blues radio station or country radio station, then it's a loss for that music and for that music community. Because how are the townspeople in that given community going to know about their local music? They have to get turned on to it. And when consolidation had started happening in the early 90s, up until that time, you still had these regions bursting out. You know, Nashville was a region that bursted out in the 50s and 60s. Seattle was a region that bursted out in the early 90s. And it goes on and on. Now you're not going to get those regional explosions until the fans and the musicians have the power again. But, you know, let it be known that Clear Channel now is starting to sell off all these stations and realizing what they were doing is working. So there is a positive spin on this, and hopefully the programming directors will have control again.
Great.
Tell us about Doyle Bramall. You featured him extensively in the interview, and he's an amazing guitarist. And one of the scenes in the movie is with Eric Clapton actually coming up on stage and playing with him in what looks like a very small nightclub. Where was that?
That was Largo in Los Angeles.
Wow.
Doyle lives in Los Angeles, and Clapton happened to be in town, and he gracefully asked him to do it. You know, Clapton's like a father figure to him. And Clapton showed up knowing that we needed to get something on film, and he obliged, and it was great. But Doyle, the reason why we featured Doyle is because so many people, at least in Austin, where I'm from, including me, kind of grew up on his music. I mean, he's a young guy, but he's been playing since his teenage years. And he was a guitarist that was literally raised by Stevie Ray Vaughan. You can't get any better than that. Mm-hmm. And so here's this guy with multiple genres of music in his career. Blues, country, rock, and a whole lot of R&B and soul music. And so when record labels get him, they don't know what to do with him. So many times they're like, okay, well, we need you to be a little bit more like Lenny Kravitz, or we need you to be a little bit more like Stevie Ray Vaughan. And they just didn't let the artist himself just grow and play the music he wanted to play. They kept dictating what they wanted him to play, and being the hard-headed artist that he is, just like me, didn't want to take orders, and so he was dropped. Not once, but three times by three different labels. And it's indicative of how the labels started to work in the 90s, the late 90s, early 2000s.
Well, has his exposure on your documentary changed anything for him? Where is he now?
Absolutely. Right now, he's touring with Clapton.
Wow. Really?
There's not a day that goes by where I don't get an email or a call or a message on MySpace asking how he's doing and where they can find him. Mm-hmm. I think the movie has lifted his spirits because it's brought his fan base out to say we want more. And quite frankly, he cannot wait to get off that Clapton tour so he can finish his next album.
Cool.
That's a nice problem to have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another thing that I thought really stood out for me when I was watching the documentary was it was Justin Goldberg, and he was talking about how the music industry had become so accustomed to the immense profits they were getting from people resetting their music collection by buying all the CDs when CDs came out, and
right.
How it's led to where we are now. I thought that was a very interesting take.
They had these bloated profits. You know, that was the day that, you know, when they went from LP to 8-track, everybody had to go buy an 8-track of the same album that they already had. They had to get Yellow Brick Road on 8-track because they already wore the needle down on Yellow Brick Road, the LP.
Yeah.
So now, you know, then you had CD come in, and or you had cassette tape come in, so everybody had to buy Yellow Brick Road on cassette. And then you had CD. And so the record companies kept making money over and over and over again. Now, we live in an era where people don't buy albums. They buy songs. And so, at least that's what they say, you know, and that could be argued. But they're not making the profits. Now musicians are becoming like teachers. They're so well-respected in the community, but they don't get paid enough. So, maybe the real musicians will emerge. I mean, you've got your whole American Idol phenomenon where everybody wants to just be a singer.
Mm-hmm.
But then musicians that are out there playing instruments, which is kind of hard to find these days, at least on television it's hard to find, they basically have a harder haul because there's a lot more competition out there. There's a lot less venues to play, and the programming directors are still consolidated. So we try to inspire them by saying, look, playing live, you know, back to the basics. Playing live is how you're going to build your audience. Reaching out to your fan through your MySpace page or your website and putting out your album on your own terms. That way, instead of making 10 cents per album, i.e. a big label record deal, you can make, you know, $9 per album if your album is selling for $11. So go do the math, folks.
Yeah.
You know, you're in control here, and there are a lot of self-service entities that can help you promote your materials. So we hope that the movie inspires people to do that.
What are some of those self-service entities?
Well, there's a lot of places. There's a lot of places where you can go if you're a band and your website is there. You know, I can't think of the names right off the head, mm-hmm. off my head, but there are Pitchfork Media. Of course, MySpace is a place where you can direct people to buy your album on Amazon or to buy your albums on iTunes. You know, you instantly get people samples of your music as soon as they log onto your page. I'm trying to think of the name. There's a bunch of retailers. There's Music Today. There's all kinds of. Dave Matthews has a great. Pardon the name. The name is escaping me, but it has a great facility in Charlottesville, Virginia, which adheres to all of these small bands so they can sell T-shirts, sell bumper stickers, and sell CDs and DVDs through this warehouse, and they don't have to have $1 million. They could do it relatively cheap. So they matter of fact, like Netflix, they sort of press it as they go.
Cool.
And it takes a little bit longer than, you know, you can't just go to the store and buy it anymore, but it takes a little bit longer, but it's worth it. And, you know, I wish I could sit down every up-and-coming bands right now and say, look, you can do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm really optimistic about the future. I mean, there's a lot of negativity in the first, you know, the first two acts because they're describing how things are, but I'm really optimistic for bands these days being able to control it themselves.
That's great. Before the Music Dies hasn't even been out for a year, and I wanted to ask you about some of its successes. Besides all of the screenings, what did it feel like when you found out that Amazon had sold out of Before the Music Dies in just a week?
Oh, well, that was surprising because we didn't really know how many people out there knew about it. because we didn't buy all of the advertising that, you know, say the movie 300 did, or Mission Impossible 2 or.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of shocking, and we were in a scramble to get more copies out there for Christmas because we didn't expect it to sell out so fast. And that was a good problem to have.
Yeah.
And it just goes to show you how much frustration there is out there about the music industry and how many people want to know more about what's going on. It's a collection of voices that are saying, hey, let's make some changes. Let's group together, you know. And I think that musicians talking to musicians was far greater than we expected.
Yeah.
Well, after talking to all of these musicians and music industry people, what's your take on what's happening, what's going to happen with these major labels?
I think that the major labels are starting to understand a lot more so than, say, the major studios are. For example, you got Viacom pulling everything off of YouTube, but yet so many people could be exposed to their shows, mm-hmm. and want to see more. I think the record labels are not, used to be like that with iTunes. They used to prevent certain big bands from being on there, and they were so dead set against downloading, you know. And now they're starting to get it, that it's exposure. And I think that they're coming around, and I think that they're, you know, with this new ruling with Clear Channel having, you know, they got busted cold turkey for having payola all over the country.
Yeah.
That I think that now that they're in trouble and now they have to sort of pay their dues and make sure that the indie bands, the indie labels get heard, it's pretty exciting. So I think the labels themselves, I know they've seen the film. We've certainly talked to a lot of label people that have. I think we're in the dawn of a new era. I think that a lot of them are going to break up because they're getting too large. And I think we're gonna see, you know, out of the dust emerge a lot of great smaller, medium-sized labels that will keep the music alive.
Yeah. I have one more question for you. This question,
sure.
It kind of ties in with your documentary that you're working on right now, The Greener Side, and also Before the Music Dies. Knowing what you know now, if you were a musician, what would success in the music business mean to you?
If I were a musician, what would the success mean to me?
Mm-hmm.
If I could, simply for me, and I like how you tied it into The Greener Side, would be able to play music and play the music I want to play and play it live and be able to go home and have my electricity paid for and my mortgage paid for and enough food to put on the table. That would pretty much for me, that would be it. And that's my best way of tying in both films. Being just content to the fact that I'm playing the music that I love and I'm able to keep food on the table and survive.
Yeah. Great.
That's great. Well, yeah. Andrew, we really appreciate you spending some time to talk with us. And we like to end
Thank you.
Our podcasts here, since we're Pirate Pods, with a good pirate arg, if you could do that for us.
The pirate arg. Let me tell you about The Greener Side. You don't need no money. Arr. How's that?
That's great. Fantastic. All right, Andrew, good luck with the documentary, and we look forward to seeing it next year.
Thank you. And thank you. I guess this is my first official interview about The Greener
Side. Oh, great.
Yeah, there you go.
Happy travels.
All right, well, thank you.
All right,
thanks
a lot.